It's called the Belarus-Poland migrant crisis, and the EU is faulting Belarus for it. It has decided to widen Belarus' sanctions as the row intensifies. But is the EU hyping the crisis against Belarus due to its disagreement with the contested presidential election, which saw Lukashenko regain his presidency? In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at whether this migrant crisis has its roots at military action that EU countries, along with the U.S., have taken in different parts of the world, especially in West Asia. First, let's get the latest on this. Jerome Hughes is our correspondent joining us from Brussels. Jerome, welcome. So what is the latest that we have on this? We know that the sanctions were extended by the EU. Tell us about that and, of course, the reaction coming from Belarus, if there was any at this point.
That's right, Kaveh. Well, the situation seems to be escalating. There's no doubt about that. I've just been reading an article in one of the so-called mainstream media outlets, the New York Times, and it talks about the fact that the EU has spent billions of euros. This is something we've been saying on Press TV for many years now. The EU is sending billions of euros to countries, say, for example, in Africa, most notably Libya, and also outside of Africa, say, Turkey, to prevent refugees from coming here. So what we're hearing is, the analysts I've been speaking to, they say this smacks of hypocrisy, that we have a situation whereby the EU is criticizing Belarus, but at the same time, look at aid agencies like Oxfam. They describe it as Fortress Europe, in other words, Fortress EU. The EU is doing all in its power to prevent refugees from coming here. And whether you describe this, as morally reprehensible or, the ethics are all wrong, actually, under international law, the EU has an obligation because rich countries have to take in those seeking asylum. But the EU has a policy of pushing back, repelling refugees. You see 15,000 troops in Poland who are trying to prevent refugees from coming here. And so there is a lot of hypocrisy. And also, it has to be pointed out that we have a situation whereby the government in Minsk, let's face it, is friendly with the government in Moscow, and you have this constant provocation. You talked about sanctions, more sanctions on Belarus, and look at what the EU lawmakers have been saying during the debates last week in the European Parliament. Many of them, not the majority, but a sizable number, have been saying that sanctions don't work. Look at the situation in Moscow, in Russia, look at the situation in Iran, South African countries, South American countries, I should say, and African countries. Sanctions don't work. It hasn't pushed back Iran. It hasn't pushed back Russia. These countries are thriving in their own way. They have other allies in other parts of the world, like China. And so these sanctions against Belarus, certainly, according to the people I've been speaking to, the EU lawmakers, the analysts, they won't work either. Constantly we hear Joseph Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, he talks about Moscow or Russia having the same size economy as California. And it's this constant, apart from the sanctions, it's this constant putting down these world powers, and it doesn't seem to work. Russia put the first man in space until Elon Musk came along. Russia, the only way the United States could get to the International Space Station was using Russian rockets. Two-thirds of the energy being used in the EU comes from Russia, and most of it passes through Belarus. So to try and belittle Russia and, you could say its friendly neighbor Belarus and putting these sanctions, the reality is they just don't seem to work.
Thank you for that. We appreciate that. That's Jerome Hughes from Brussels with the latest on that. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from London. Also joining us is Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, who joins us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Joyce Amioli, I'm going to start with you. Quickly, if you can, give us the short version of what you see as transpiring there on the Poland-Belarus border, how you view this migrant crisis, and whether it's being politicized.
Well, unfortunately, it is indeed being politicized. I mean, the European Union is playing quite a slimy game here. I mean, they really don't care too much about these migrants who are already now freezing in this icy winter temperatures. They want to score political points against Belarus. And, of course, they're trying to blame Russia for this. And Russia, of course, has nothing whatever to do with this. Look, as I think your correspondent pointed out, the EU has had these problems before. Erdogan in Turkey has something like 3-4 million refugees that he repeatedly threatens to unleash on the EU, and Germany regularly pays him off in order to stop him doing so. There are migrants who are, that are coming from North Africa, you know, in their, when they're in the Mediterranean, they're shipped off to Italy. We have migrants crossing the English Channel. Again, you know, whenever they're apprehended on the English Channel, the British ship them to safety. So what's so special about this case? Why is it that the EU is unable to do anything at all to help? Well, what's so special is they're coming from Belarus and he wants to score points against Belarus. There's a very simple solution to this, which is pick up a phone, call Lukashenko, and ask him what is his price. I'm pretty sure his price is a lot lower than Erdogan's price. Belarus is a tiny country compared to Turkey, and all he probably wants is sanctions being lifted off Minsk, but the EU, for ideological reasons, isn't prepared to pay that price.
What was Turkey's price, by the way, do you know?
I think it's something like 3-4 billion euros.
Okay, so Markus Papadopoulos, let me review with you this EU accusation and see what you think, where the EU has accused Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian president, orchestrating the influx of migrants to pressure it to back down over sanctions slapped on the government. Now, Belarus has dismissed that as being absurd. How do you view it?
The tension on the Polish-Belarusian border is not in itself about migrants. After all, America, Britain, the European Union and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants to enter Europe as a result of Britain, America, NATO and the EU having destabilized both Libya and Syria through having supported terrorists in both countries. No. What we see at the Polish-Belarusian border is geostrategic politics in action, and specifically, Russia is the target. Firstly, America and Britain do not wish the union states of Russia and Belarus, let us remember, Belarus is the historical name of Belarus, they do not want the union state of Russia and Belarus to materialize, whereby Belarus will reunify with Russia. Why? Because in the event of the union state of Russia and Belarus coming into being, Russian national security in Eastern Europe will receive a tremendous boost. Secondly, America and Britain are trying to foment civil unrest in Belarus in the hope that this will assist them in their quest to initiate a coup in Belarus aimed to bring down President Alexander Lukashenko, to wrestle Belarus out of Moscow's orbit and into the West's sphere of influence. And thirdly, NATO, which of course is directed by Washington and London, is looking for a pretext to increase NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic, and of course in the Black Sea region, which of course is an anti-Russia motivation. And as a result of the last few days, what we now see is NATO having its pretext to go ahead in increasing its soldiery and weaponry along the Russian border. As I said at the beginning, this situation on the Polish-Belarusian border has nothing to do with migrants. After all, there are only a few thousand migrants at the Belarusian, the Polish-Belarusian border, and yet the Americans, the British, the EU and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants into Europe a few years ago.
Right. Well, let's see here. First of all, George Samioli, do you agree with the assessment they're made and the analysis they're made by Marcus Papadopoulos?
I do. I think that there is clearly a strategic agenda here. It's been of long standing, which is to topple the government of Lukashenko in Belarus and thereby weaken Russia substantially. Let's keep in mind that the regime change that the Western powers engineered in Ukraine in February of 2014 was a strategic blow to Russia. There's no question. I mean, that having bad relations with a country that is basically kind of a brother nation that is Ukraine was a huge blow to Russia, and losing Belarus would indeed be something that would be strategically catastrophic. And that is why I believe that that the EU and the United Kingdom and NATO want to continue to aggravate this crisis at the border and make this into this giant propaganda exercise in demonizing both Russia and Belarus. I mean, how is Russia in any way involved in this? And yet, if you listen to, or rather read the article written by UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss over the weekend, somehow it is all Russia's fault because Russia was supposed to have leaned on Lukashenko and told him what to do, which kind of undermines the whole idea that, you know, Belarus and Russia are kind of two separate states. So I think that there's no question that that is the agenda. And of course, as Marcus points out, I mean, we're only talking about a few thousand. So it is fascinating to see why this sudden hysteria about a few thousand when, you know, in 2015, you know, a million migrants were absorbed by the EU. And again, why focus there rather than on what's going on, say, in the English Channel? Are they coming from Belarus? Are the migrants that are coming from North Africa and going to Italy, are they coming from Belarus? So you know, this is all a part of the kind of engineering this hostile alliance against Russia.
Okay, so we have what has been described by you, Marcus Papadopoulos, which the main target appears to be Russia, as you said. But looking at Moscow's reaction is a bit of an eye-opener because, from what we understand, Moscow sent nuclear-capable bombers to patrol the Belarusian skies and nations bordering Belarus. As a result, have voiced alarm because of that. How do you view Russia's reaction militarily here in terms of sending these bombers?
Belarus and the Russian Federation, on paper, are two separate countries. The truth of the matter, however, is that Belarus is de facto a part of the Russian Federation. The Belarusian armed forces are de facto a part of the Western military district of the Russian Federation. However, whilst the chances of a Western coup succeeding in Belarus are negligible, Russia cannot take any chances whatsoever. That is why Russia has learned from its mistakes it made regarding Ukraine at the end of 2013 and the beginning of 2014, when the Kremlin was very, very slow to react to what was clearly a Western orchestrated coup in the making. So in regard to Belarus, that is why the Kremlin has dispatched nuclear bombers to safeguard the borders of Belarus and effectively the borders of the Union State of Russia and Belarus. That is also why the Kremlin has dispatched Russian paratroopers to safeguard the border of Belarus, which of course is also the border of the Union State of Russia and Belarus. In hypothetically speaking, if a Western coup was to succeed in Belarus and Belarus was to be brought into the West's sphere of influence, that would be a catastrophic setback for Russian national security, because what it would mean is that the entire frontier of the Russian Federation in the West, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, would be enclosed with countries which are in the West's sphere of influence. And we know already that Britain has sent soldiers to Poland to, officially speaking, advise the Polish government on how to secure its border. My own personal view is those British soldiers should actually be in Dover, actually safeguarding Britain's border against illegal migration across the English Channel. And also, the British have said that they have 600 paratroopers and SAS soldiers ready to go to Poland if the situation deteriorates on the Belarusian-Polish border.
Okay.
So that is why Russia is taking the situation so very seriously, but also Russia is compelled to because of the Union State of Russia and Belarus, which, I should add, will materialise sooner rather than later.
Okay, well, we do need to talk about the humanitarian aspect of this, George Zamiali, and the hypocrisy that's involved. At the top of the broadcast or the program, we had our correspondent talk about how what EU says and does is hypocritical, because it spends billions to stop these refugees from coming to the EU countries, even though as a rich nation they need to take in some refugees. We can have your reaction on that issue, and also how, for example, the U.S. Stops migrants crossing the border from, for example, Mexico, never mind the harsh treatment that these migrants receive. So are we sensing here a sense of hypocrisy from the EU and the U.S. also?
Well, yes. It is kind of interesting that the accusations against Belarus that, Belarus is to blame for the migrant flow. Well, no one in the United States would ever, at least no respectable person in the United States would try to do that in Mexico. They say, well, if Mexico is to blame for the migrant flow that's quite substantial into the United States. But in terms of the humanitarianism, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have these migrants now sleeping out in the cold. This is now getting, it's middle of November. It is very, very cold. And why is this happening? Well, it's happening because the EU, NATO, the United Kingdom, and the United States want to use this as a massive propaganda campaign against Russia and Belarus, and therefore to show, hey, these are the people we're up against. So we've got a democracy summit that's scheduled for December the 9th and December the 10th, so it's in about 3 weeks' time. And, what's going to be on the agenda? Well, the agenda will be the terrible people such as Russia and Belarus, because Iran will be included in that. But that is part of the ideological mobilization that NATO is continuing to engage in. So they really don't care about the plight of these migrants. I think they're quite happy to have this on the news every night. And then they point to, hey, well, who's to blame? Well, it's these terrible people, Putin and Lukashenko. And, and this is being done, stated explicitly by Western officials, as I say, by the UK Foreign Secretary, who's now, going around mouthing this nonsense day after day.
So let's try to figure out through you, Marcus Papadopoulos, what is going to happen in this situation. One aspect of it, which was interesting, was the fact that the Belarusian President Lukashenko threatened to cut off gas supplies to Europe, and Putin said that he did not approve of that, in so many words. And he said that, I think, he said perhaps Lukashenko said that in a fit of anger. Do you see something like that transpiring? I mean, at this point, the EU has leveled sanctions. It may even go further. How do you see it?
No, I do not see gas supplies being cut off whatsoever. After all, as I said moments ago, Belarus is de facto a part of the Russian Federation, and under no circumstances will the Kremlin allow anything to disrupt the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe. Why? Because in a scenario where the flow of natural gas, Russian natural gas to Europe, is disrupted, the Russian economy would suffer immensely, and would suffer immensely overnight. And let us not forget that the West sanctions on Russia, which have been in force for coming up to 8 years now, are very severe. And one of the ways that Russia has managed to mitigate the losses it sustained is by increasing the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe, but also to China. So undoubtedly, Lukashenko made that comment either in a fit of rage or to provoke the West, but under no circumstances will the Russian natural gas be disrupted in its flow to Europe. No. What we will see is, as a result of the tension on the Polish-Belarusian border, we will see NATO's presence increase in Eastern Europe and in the Baltic and in the Black Sea, and consequently we will see Russia and Belarus's initiative to initiate the reunification of the two countries come into play sooner rather than later.
Okay.
And the West has actually inadvertently sped up the integration between Belarus and Russia, because Moscow and Minsk clearly understand there is a very serious threat posed to Belarus by NATO and the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Russia will safeguard its security on its western border, and in fact increase enormously its security on its western border, is by ensuring that Russia and Belarus reunify. And as I keep on saying, that will happen sooner rather than later.
Do you think that a reunification is going to be the outcome here, George Samueli? Is it even required, given the fact that we know Russia does support Belarus in the form and fashion that it has?
Well, that's it. I think that the unification has been an ongoing thing, and de facto they are one country, particularly as Belarus is clearly under threat, and the only thing that saves Belarus is that it's that Russia has its back. I mean, you know, obviously there are lots of issues that need to be ironed out before they can become one state, but de facto it is one state, and that's, and therefore anyone who tries anything with Belarus knows that they have Russia to deal with. And Russia has made this very clear, that in any attempt at staging a coup in Minsk will be met with force from Moscow. So, yeah, de facto, it is essentially already one state.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos from London. Thank you for your comments. And senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, spoke to us from Budapest, and we had our correspondent Jerome Hughes spoke to us from Brussels. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitale and entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisin, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. They will say, "Our Lord, our wretchedness overcame us, and we were a people astray."
Brothers and sisters, in the previous verse we discussed, it was mentioned that Almighty Allah would address the wrongdoers in the Resurrection Day with reproach and will say, "Alam takun ayati tutla alaykum? Were not my signs recited to you, then you used to belie them?" And in this verse, they will confess it, and as the verse says, قَالُوا رَبَّنَا غَلَبَتْ عَلَيْنَا شِقْوَتُنَا وَكُنَّا قَوْمًا ضَالِّينَ. They will say, "Our Lord, our adversity conquered us, and we were a people gone astray." The Arabic word shiqwa and shiqawa is the opposite of the word felicity, and it means the trouble, punishment and calamity prepared for some people. In other words, the wrongdoers will be overwhelmed by the evils and disasters. And on the other hand, felicity means blessing and goodness in store for the people who have done good in the world. Anyway, in both cases, adversity and felicity are only the consequences of our intentions. They are not the consequences of what we could not control in the world. They are the consequences of our words, our deeds, our intentions, and whatever we did in this world. The belief that felicity and adversity are realities in themselves with which someone is born is only a product of our imagination, and it is completely against the call of all the apostles and the efforts of all the great divine guides and all the teachers of mankind. This is an idea for those who want to avoid their responsibilities, and this will be a means whereby they can justify their evil actions, sometimes justify their ignorance at least.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
فَبَدَا وَضِيئًا كَالنُّجُومِ تَأَلُّقًا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The hellish wrongdoers in the core of their being indeed confess that they are aware of Almighty Allah's punishment and that they were an erring people, but they themselves had prepared the ground for their misfortune in the day of resurrection. That's why they will say, رَبَّنَا غَلَبَتْ عَلَيْنَا شِقْوَتُنَا. They will say, our Lord, our adversity conquered us. وَكُنَّا قَوْمًا ضَالِّينَ. And as a result, we were a people gone astray. The interesting point, as I mentioned in the beginning of the program, is that the signs of the Almighty Allah used to be recited to them. They were aware of the fact that there is a resurrection, that there is a kind of hereafter that the prophets and the great divine guides have been talking about, but they did not listen. So they were gone astray by not listening to the words of the prophets and the great divine guides. So أَلَمْ تَكُنْ آيَاتِ تُتْلَى عَلَيْكُمْ. Were not my signs recited to you and you used to belie them? And as a result, they would confess in this world that رَبَّنَا غَلَبَتْ عَلَيْنَا شِقْوَتُنَا. So this is the very result and consequence of not listening to the words of the great divine guides. And the wrongdoers themselves will be aware and they will be awakened on the day of hereafter, and they will confess, they will have no other way but to confess to their misbehaviors and wrongdoings in the world. And they will confess that they themselves have been the main cause of the situation they are in the day of resurrection. That's why in the next verse, they will ask the Almighty Allah to return them. And they will try to use their confession to attract Almighty Allah's blessings. We will talk about the next verse in the next program. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me. Why? And when faith begins.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In an interview released by Al-Qaeda's media, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khaled Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz.
Al-Qaeda leader's confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudi-led coalition using terrorists to support its mercenaries, and this confession may be through which the Al-Qaeda leader is trying to prove their presence and that they have a role in a battle that has been going on for years. We will continue to liberate all Yemeni lands from terrorist organizations, whether in Marib or elsewhere.
Experts say the U.S. has been using and supporting terrorist groups in Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war, just as it has supported the Saudi war on Yemen. They say the Yemeni army has proven this by seizing caches of weapons bearing USAID logos in Al-Qaeda arms depots.
The U.S. is the main supporter of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and all terrorist organizations, and it seeks to control the countries in which the terrorists are present. When it comes to Yemen, Al-Qaeda failed in this, and the Yemeni army managed to expel the terrorists from their main stronghold in Al-Baida Governorate. The Yemeni army found tons of U.S.-made weapons in Al-Qaeda's warehouses in Al-Baida, and this is another proof that the United States is the main supporter of terrorist organizations.
Earlier this year, Yemen's Interior Ministry also said Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's Marib province, where the Yemeni army is pressing ahead with a liberation offensive, which Riyadh denied.
The statement by the Al-Qaeda leader shines a new light on how the Saudi-led war has helped prop up terrorist groups in Yemen with the help of the U.S. Yemenis, however, believe that their army will eventually liberate the entire territory of their country from terrorist groups and occupiers. Abdul Latif Al-Washal, Sana'a.
The Palestinian Authority is experiencing the worst fiscal difficulties it has ever had since its establishment more than a quarter century ago. PA officials say this could soon reflect on its ability to pay its employees' salaries and conduct daily business. The European Union is the PA's largest single donor, but the bloc has not donated any aid to the authority so far in 2021. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohamed Ishtayi has meanwhile told his cabinet several days ago that the PA hasn't either received any financial aid from the Arab countries for 2 years.
There's no doubt that the PA is going through a real and suffocating financial crisis. Its manifestations are evident. There's a budget deficit, an accumulation of debt, and delays in paying its obligations, the salaries, paying for the education, infrastructure, health, and all sections. It's undeniable that there is a clear decline in aid.
along with the long-standing fiscal leakages that are contributing to the financial crisis, Israel continues to deduct millions of U.S. dollars every month from clearance revenue transfers. This is in response to the payments by the Palestinian Authority to the prisoners held in Israeli jails, their families, and the families of those killed by Israeli forces.
Taxes collected by Israel on behalf of the PA, including customs duties, constitute a major source of revenue for the Palestinian economy. Israel often uses the fund transfers as the bargaining chip in its volatile relationship with the PA. They do not want for the PA to have any strength. They want to use the money it deducts to keep control in a way or another on the PA.
Meanwhile, the World Bank called on donors to help reduce the budget deficit, saying that the financial situation remains fragile due to high public spending and very low external financing to the PA.
At the end of the day, observers have expressed concern that the increasingly cash-strapped PA could face financial collapse. PA officials say the main reason behind the financial crisis is the lack of international and Arab donations to the Palestinians. Wana Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
Vienna's International Book Fair, cancelled like many other events in 2020, has come back to life this year. With only vaccinated or recovered people allowed into the exhibition hall, visitors can move freely without face masks. More than 300 publishers from over 30 countries used the opportunity to showcase their new releases. One of them was Iran.
We are also pleased to have another event for Iran's presentation of Iranian culture, Iranian science and technology in the format of the excellent and eloquent books that have been produced by Iranian scholars and gifted philosophers.
Books here are mainly bilingual, an opportunity for cultural exchange.
This year, I'm very happy because one of my poetry books, which was published in Iran, is on display here. Of course, Iran is the center of poetry, and Iranian culture is deeply intertwined with poetry. I really wanted to publish my poems in Persian, since my previous work, published here in Austria, was only in German.
For many, visiting the Iran stand was a trip down memory lane.
Mashhad.
I traveled from Tehran to Mashhad by train and then visited other cities by bus. I met a lot of different people, not just Iranians, but also tourists from other countries. As foreigners, we were impressed with the Iranian people's warm response and their positive attitude. It was a very interesting, unforgettable, and beautiful trip. I hope I can visit Iran again.
Vienna's Book Fair is the center of a week-long national reading festival, involving hundreds of authors in dozens of venues.
Although many feared the book industry would not be able to weather the storm of the pandemic, hopes have actually risen for the industry, with people reading more in lockdown, some even discovering for the first time the unique kind of pleasure that reading provides. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On Sunday, the Afghan capital, Kabul, hosted a webinar titled Muslim World Ulamas and the Recent Developments in Afghanistan. Top clerics from seven Islamic countries, namely Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Iran, Palestine, Iraq, and Croatia, participated in the event. They said the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan opened a new chapter in the country, adding that it's up to the new rulers to form an inclusive government and maintain stability.
Afghans are proud people. They succeeded to defeat the U.S. and its allies and free their country. We hope the new administration learns from the past and understands that no one can rule over Afghanistan with dictatorship and oppression. I think Afghanistan must have a popular and inclusive government in order to prevent disputes.
We welcome the recent developments in our country, as it is meant to cease hostilities and violence on our soil. We are happy that our people don't hear the news of war every day, or at least hear lesser than they did during the invasion. But the fact is that recent terrorist attacks show that we are still far from permanent security and peace.
The attendees also stressed the need for Islamic solidarity and urged the Taliban and Afghans to stay awake and knowledgeable to foil enemies' scheme.
My advice to the Afghan people is that they should launch an educational movement and everyone should be illiterate so that they can detect enemies' plots. In addition, there should be a solidarity between Muslim brothers because their enemies are trying to sow sedition between Shias and Sunnis, especially by carrying out deadly attacks.
Addressing the conference, the clerics also asked the Islamic countries to help Afghans amid difficulties and economic hardship. The participants of the webinar stressed unity among all Muslims, especially in Afghanistan. This as the Taliban government is yet to be recognized by world countries and people are facing looming crisis. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A two-day photographic and film exhibition on the annual pilgrimage of Arba'in began in the Italian capital on Saturday. Arba'in marks the 40th day of the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Imam of Shia Muslims. It is commemorated annually through a march being the biggest in the world and known as Arba'in Pilgrimage from different countries to Karbala and holding ceremonies in the Iraqi city. The photo exhibition, organized by the Imam Mehdi Islamic Association and the NGO Arba'in Travelogue, showcases a selection of photos from the world's largest gathering in late September this year. The main focus of the initiative is global justice.
We do our best to bring the message of Arba'in to Europe, to every country, to every city, to every each of one of those people, and say the truth that Arba'in is follow the global peace, global justice. And global justice, global peace, global empathy is what we're missing now.
There is an amazing atmosphere in Karbala. Iraqi people welcomed us the best way they could. The first time I went there, Saddam Hussein had just been removed. I traveled all the way from Iran to the Holy Shrine. It was an unforgettable experience.
Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Shia Muslim pilgrims converged on Karbala in late September to commemorate the end of the 40-day mourning period for the death of Imam Hussein.
People at the photo exhibition say Arba'in should be seen as a model for our societies, one in which each and every one of us has a role, irrespective of our nationality, financial status, and ethnic or religious background.
I think it would be really nice to take it as a model because you see that everything is there organized by people who are doing their best without any rules, without any fines, without any pushing from the outside. So it can be implemented to our daily life. And hopefully I would say that the people could be inspired by it and try to have it in their daily life as much as possible.
Ciò che avviene durante la marcia del quarantesimo.
What happens during the Arba'in can inspire our societies. Generosity, sacrifice, selflessness, these are values that better our societies, and that's what we should all aim at.
Some 14 million worshippers attended the Arba'in in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
Ten innocent family members were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to these promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. And the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pervasive challenges remain for migrants and asylum seekers, no matter Europe, the United States, or Asia. The recent immigrant crisis on the Belarusian border with Poland has refreshed the plight refugees have endured at the hands of some governments. Thousands of asylum seekers are currently stranded in desperate conditions on the Belarusian border, with thousands of Polish soldiers, guards, and police on the other side blocking their entry. Ironically, the European Union has backed Poland's move in line with the bloc's resolve that it will go to any length to prevent migrants from reaching its external borders. This means turning a blind eye to even gross human rights abuses against refugees. Instead of searching for a mechanism to resolve the crisis, the EU has rather opened a diplomatic war with Belarus and Russia by directly pointing its finger at the two for the current problem. The 27-member bloc is not an exception. Just recently, the United States violently encountered with mostly Haitian immigrants near its borders. Hundreds were deported and thousands were sent to detention centers. It seems the Biden administration has continued the footsteps of its predecessor that took a tough stance on asylum seekers. An estimated 70,000 people destined for the U.S. have encountered with similar fates over the past 4 years. The brutal family separation was the darkest part of the Trump era, as authorities are still unable to track down parents of hundreds of kids. The treatment of immigrants by the U.S. highlights its double standards on human rights. The issue Washington often uses as a pretext to impose sanctions on others. But the real question is, what is the root cause of the migrant crisis? Isn't the West, especially the United States, the main culprit for its wars and the subsequent influx of refugees in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a live example that was left in a mess by the U.S. and its allies after almost 2 decades of military presence. People had no choice but to flee the country after the Taliban takeover in mid-August. The number of immigrants has even increased in neighboring Iran, with over 5,000 Afghans reportedly entering the country on a daily basis. The UN has praised Iran, but the sanctions-hit country hasn't received some $136 million in funding the world body said the Islamic Republic needed to support the refugees.
Tens of thousands of workers belonging to South Korea's largest umbrella labor union rallied on the streets of downtown Seoul, defying a city government ban on their gathering.
The current infringement of basic rights by the government under the name of coronavirus prevention is a blindly criminal act which destroys the Constitution.
At the rally location in 1970, 22-year-old Chun Tae-il burned himself to death to protest against the terrible working conditions he endured. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit those in the service sector particularly hard, with layoffs and reductions in hours.
This year especially, many casual workers have suffered because of the coronavirus. They've lost their jobs and had their income reduced due to unpaid leave. We are holding this rally to stop this irrationality.
Demonstrators also protested the gap between regular and irregular workers and a growing disparity between haves and have-nots. South Korean truckers and railway workers have been threatening walkouts recently, with Hyundai union workers voting to strike Friday. South Koreans will be heading to the polls in about 5 months to elect a new president of the country. The main candidates have been decided, and now political forces like the unionists here today have begun to battle to see their interests top the campaign agenda. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Oh.
In a fresh air strike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, 4 civilians, including 3 children, were killed. 2 others were also wounded in the strike in Tuhaita district in the Hodeidah province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tuhaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeidah Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbrokered agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeidah, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeidah, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces.
Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldens Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a 2-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounce the agreement. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is the UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.